served as a two-term mayor of Miami Beach. Now, Democrat Philip Levine wants to be Florida's next governor. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to get the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, former Mayor Phil Levine in studio to take your calls as we continue to profile the candidates in the running to become the next governor of Florida. What are your questions for the candidate? Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, it's almost time for the return of One Spark in Jacksonville. We'll have a look ahead to that. Plus, educators speak out about a new law they say could lead to a teacher's shortage in Florida. We'll tell you about that, too. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, he's the former mayor of Miami Beach, and he's one of four major candidates looking to win the Democratic nomination for governor of Florida. Philip Levine is touting his American dream roots as a successful entrepreneur and his tenure as a progressive mayor of a large South Florida city in his run for the nomination. Levine joins us now in studio with more about his campaign and the biggest issues facing the state. Philip Levine, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa, for the opportunity.
And what are your questions for former Miami Beach mayor and gubernatorial candidate Philip Levine? Get on the line now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937, or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. We also welcome your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Lots of people already commenting there. We'll get to those in a few minutes. Philip Levine, it's great to have you on the show. You are one of four major candidates running for the Democratic nomination, former mayor of Miami Beach. You're running on that record and also your record as a successful businessman, a strong progressive vision. You, in particular, you're emphasizing issues like how Florida should deal with sea level rise and climate change, wage inequality, gun control. These are all traditional planks of the Democratic platform. And they're ones that your opponents are talking about on the campaign trail, too. So what differentiates you from your opponents? Why should the voters choose you?
Well, Melissa, first of all, thank you again. You know, it's interesting. I started with $500 and a pocket full of dreams. And I started a little company that became a big company. And I was fortunate enough to sell it and then became mayor. But, you know, the one thing we've always learned in the private sector, which is really important, is judge not people by what they say they're going to do. Judge people by what they've actually done in their background. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to some of these issues you brought up, like progressive credentials, when it comes to sea level rise and climate change, being the mayor of Miami Beach, we put together a $500 million program, began raising roads, putting in pumps, changing building codes, raising our seawalls, which, by the way, Melissa, is very much what you need to do on the St. John River, because I was here right after Hurricane Irma, and I saw the flooding in your downtown area. So what has to happen is what we did in Miami Beach. When it comes to minimum living wage, I think all of us agree that you can't live on $8.25 an hour. So as opposed to talking about it, I actually did it as the mayor. We passed the first minimum living wage in the history of the state of Florida. And we're being sued by it. We're being sued by the governor, the state of Florida. We plan to go to the Florida Supreme Court this year, and we think we're going to win because it's the right thing to do. But getting to other issues you brought up, for example, gun reform. In Miami Beach, we passed an assault weapons ban. Now, we know, of course, that it's non-binding because this legislature acts like Big Brother, and they tell every local community what they can and cannot do, but we actually did it. When it comes to marijuana, for example, we decriminalized it in Miami Beach. We didn't just talk about it. Various issues, LGBTQ issues, mm-hmm. Perfect score in Miami Beach. So it's interesting. I always say that I wouldn't look to elect or hire a CEO of an organization or a state unless they could show me what they've really done as opposed to talk.
And those are all things you did as a public official. Let's take them one by one. Let's begin with climate change and sea level rise. As you pointed out, downtown Jacksonville flooded in the wake of Hurricane Irma. Inland flooding, along with coastal flooding, is expected to have a major economic impact and environmental impact on this state with a warming planet and with melting ice caps. You've taken a really proactive stance on this in South Florida, as have a number of other public office holders down there, both Democratic and Republican, because the water's already coming in down there. So that's a municipal and public works problem you've had to deal with in real time. How would you, as governor, take this issue statewide? Florida has thousands of miles of coastline and valuable coastal property that's at risk. How are you going to address that for the state? And how are you going to work with a legislature that, as you pointed out, is conservative? And there are a number of representatives and state senators who disagree with you about this issue. They don't accept the science behind climate change, and they might not go along with your program.
Well, Melissa, I'll tell you this. The ocean's continuing to rise, and that rising ocean is not Republican, and it's not Democrat. It's just an ocean. So I could take somebody who doesn't believe that the planet is warming, and I'll put them on the banks of the St. John River right here in Jacksonville during a horrible king tide, during a hurricane, during some type of event. And as that water overflows, I bet I'll convert them. Same in Miami Beach. I think what's happening is, call it what you may, the fact of the matter is 79% of Florida's coastlines are under threat. Those coastlines house a tremendous amount of population and trillions of dollars of real estate, which pay taxes.
And how will you protect that real estate and the coast?
What we need to do is this. Number one, I've learned this. One size does not fit all. The solution for Jacksonville is different than the solution for Miami Beach. For the Tampa Bay effort, it's different than it is in Miami Beach. What we need to do, number one, is get smart. We need a chief resiliency officer in the state of Florida. We are the first city in Florida to actually do it. We need a statewide chief resiliency officer.
You have a resiliency officer in Miami
Beach. Absolutely. 100%. Number two, we need regional resiliency officers around the state to coordinate with our state chief resiliency officer. The other thing we need to do is we need to realize these once in a century hurricanes are no longer once a century. They could be once a year going forward. So we need to make sure that we have the proper resiliency funding in place to help communities that can't necessarily do it on their own and they don't have the expertise. We need to have a certain type of matching fund program so that they can begin creating a level of resiliency. We can't afford not to take this seriously and make sure our state has a future. Because if we want Amazon and eBay and Apple and Boeing and Lockheed and General Electric, all these great companies to come to Florida to have high-paying jobs, by the way, they want to know that they have a future here. They want to know the state's investing in their future. That's key.
How do you define resiliency, and would you advocate for different policies when it comes to building along the coasts? Well, how will we ensure these properties in the coming years?
Well, resiliency is many different definitions depending on where you are. In South Florida, resiliency could be everything from making sure we have renourishment of our sand on our beaches to making sure that the Everglades stays clean so that we have the ability to have fresh drinking water. Resiliency would mean not having offshore drilling so we don't destroy our beaches. So resiliency has multiple definitions going forward. But I think the number one answer to this is the fact that without us focusing on it, we won't have a future. And as a governor, if I'm honored to be elected, it will be a top priority for our state.
Okay, and it's 549-2937. We'll go to your calls in a moment for former Miami Beach Mayor Phil Levine. He's running for the Democratic nomination for Florida governor. Now, you mentioned a number of other issues that you're running on as your record as a former mayor of a South Florida city. 10 mayors from South Florida sued the state the other day, seeking the authority to regulate firearms on the municipal level without facing fines or being kicked out of office. That's in response to a 2011 statute that penalizes local elected officials who try to enact their own gun control laws. You mentioned your stance on weapons. I want to ask you your thoughts on the legislation Florida just passed in the wake of the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland that killed 17 people, and how you would approach this issue as governor.
First of all, it's a horrible tragedy. As a parent, as somebody that went to high school, public high school in Broward County, it affected everybody. The issue is this, like I said before, you have a legislature that is owned by the NRA. The NRA means not responsible for anything. We have folks up there that literally their jobs are more important than the safety of our children. We need to change that. These mayors in South Florida that are going to legal battle are brave for doing what they know is the right thing to do. What we are seeing out of Tallahassee is the preemption of local governments. Now, Thomas Jefferson said, government works best that's closest to its people. If I'm honored to be elected governor, I'm going to allow the local communities once again to be able to control their own local laws and regulations because they know what's best for their communities. So going forward, number one, I believe that we need to make sure in Tallahassee we ban assault rifles, we have better background checks, and we have folks that have mental health issues cannot own weapons in Florida. If we are unable to convince the legislature in November, December, next year, then what we're going to do is bring it to the people. And I believe the people of Florida, through a referendum, will say we do not want assault rifles in Florida.
You'll now, start a petition drive for a ballot amendment on this issue.
Absolutely, 100%. And you'll have a governor out there campaigning for people to sign it and put it on the referendum. Now, if we're not able to do that, plan B would be another referendum item to make sure that folks agree that they'd rather have their local elected leaders decide their gun safety policy as opposed to Tallahassee. Listen, we see it happening in Tallahassee. It's a little bit like Big Brother, like the Soviet Union used to run things. You know, central control out of Moscow, and they make all the decisions. Well, that didn't work out too well for the Soviet Union. Now, we don't believe this is the right way to govern in the state of Florida. We need to put the power back with the people.
And for listeners across North Florida listening to you now and listening to some of the other Democratic candidates that have appeared on this program, these are all ideas that your former constituency in South Florida were very much aligned with you on. When you get north of the I-4 corridor in Florida, though, the old saying is you have to go north to get to the south. There are a lot of voters up in this part of the state that will vehemently disagree with your platform, whether it's on guns, climate, LGBTQ equality, a $15 an hour minimum wage, or all of these traditionally Democratic ideas you're running on. So, Philip Levine, how can you beat a Republican opponent in a general election that's going to accuse you of being too liberal? You're also a wealthy entrepreneur. They're going to say that you're a wheeler dealer politician who can't be trusted, that maybe you've done shady business deals. They're going to attack you on any number of those issues. You've also been hit in the Miami New Times for taking $200,000 from a Russian oligarch. Democratic voters won't like hearing that. How are you going to beat a Republican in a general election that's going to appeal more to conservative voters?
Sure. Well, Melissa, that's a great question. And number one, I could tell you this. You know, it's interesting. You know, thank God everyone's telling me based on the latest polls, I'm the top of the poll. I'm the front runner now of the Democratic Party. But what I have learned.
What poll said that?
Oh, multiple. Gravis poll, PPP poll, and other ones out there that are independently done polls. But the interesting thing about it, everywhere I go, I get people coming up to me, Republicans, and saying, Mayor, I'm a lifelong Republican. I've never voted for a Democrat in my entire life. I just heard you speak. And matter of fact, you're the first Democrat I'm ever going to vote for. I hear it everywhere I go. And you know what the reason is? Is because as a business person, as an entrepreneur who's running on a platform and being pro-people and pro-business, who understands that in order for us to get the Apples, the eBays, the Amazons, the GE, the Lockheeds, the Boeing to come to Florida, we need to do the right thing. And that's education. That's healthcare. That's making sure that our Silicon Valley is our NASA. That is our Silicon Valley. Making sure that we have the right environmental policies and making sure that we have non-discrimination. That's what these great companies are doing. And I got to tell you something. What's amazing is that the amount of Republican support that I'm getting is unprecedented going forward.
How can you measure that?
Well, I could tell you this because I hear it on the street. We hear it and we see it in polls. But the other thing, Melissa, which is more important, is that everywhere I go, people in Florida want the same thing. They want fresh water. They want better paying jobs. They want health care. They want affordable housing. They want non-discrimination. They all want the same thing. What happens is that people try to separate us as Floridians or Americans, but you know what the reality is? We all want the same things. We want safe schools. We want better schools. All Floridians want the same things. And I believe I have a track record, both in the private and in the public sector, of actually getting things done.
Okay, let's go to your calls now for former Miami Beach Mayor Phil Levine. He's running for Florida governor. What are your questions for this candidate? 549-2937. Mylon in Ponte Vedra Beach. Mylon, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning, Philip. I love, Philip's talk here, especially, you know, the stance against the NRA. And God, you know, the parents, you know, of that school, they deserve someone. They deserve someone to stand up for them, you know, and they need people, you know, to talk this up, especially the gun issue, you know, and I think it's, you know, it's common sense what, you know, the points that Philip has raised. That's what I wanted to say.
Okay.
Hey, Melissa, can I say one thing which is interesting right now? Based on the polling we've seen, the ban on assault rifles is somewhere approaching 70% of Floridians. So we know that members of the NRA want this ban. They want better background checks. And there's something else. I'm a gun owner. I actually own guns.
What kind of guns do you own?
I have a 44 Magnum. I have 38 revolvers. I have a concealed weapons permit. I'm a gun owner. No one wants to take guns away. But I could tell you one thing. We now have the weakest gun safety laws in the nation. If I'm honored to be elected governor, we will have the safest gun regulation in the nation.
How will you take on the NRA and its chief lobbyist, Marion Hammer, who's seen to wield, you know, unprecedented sway in Tallahassee in terms of driving legislation that is friendly to the gun lobby?
We're going to take it to the people, Melissa. That's what we're going to do. That's what I've done always when I was mayor. That's what we're going to do in Florida. We're going to take it to the people. And I believe the people will be the wind in our sails to get what needs to be done. And as you know, there's some elections going on this year, and there seems to be a wave and a lot of people getting up and saying enough is enough. I believe you're going to see some big changes in Tallahassee. But listen, as a business person, as an entrepreneur, we got to follow Delta, follow Dick's Sporting Goods, follow the private sector who is saying to us, you all are backwards. We actually make money off these guns and we're going to do the right thing. And unfortunately, Tallahassee, who's paid off by the not responsible for anything gang, they're not doing the right thing. So let the people vote them out of office.
And that's easier said than done in a state like many states that's gerrymandered to benefit one political party over another. You can say, oh, vote them out. That doesn't always happen in terms of the way legislative and congressional districts are drawn. So how would your rhetoric square with that reality if you're elected?
Well, I think we've seen it nationwide. We saw it in Pennsylvania for a congressional seat that was 20 points Trump that all of a sudden went Democratic. We saw it with this Margaret Good in Southwest Florida, who, by the way, was in a Republican area, and she won as a Democrat. I think people, they don't care if you're Republican or Democrat or independent. People are people. They want change. They want to see the right thing done. They're terrified of the narrative of the country right now. And by the way, the feeling in Florida is this is not good for business.
When you say they're terrified of the narrative of the country, are you talking about the Trump administration?
Absolutely,
100%. Are you going to run against Donald Trump in the state of Florida?
You know, it's interesting. I don't run against anybody. I run with my own message. I always say I'm not right and I'm not left. I'm forward. I'm running as a Democrat, but before I'm a Democrat, I'm an American. And the one thing I know, Melissa, is that no one has a monopoly on good ideas, not Democrats, not Republicans, and not independents. And that's how I operate, and that's how I run, and that's how I built my businesses.
Okay, let's go to a few comments on Facebook. Lots of people weighing in there for former Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine. He's running for the Democratic nomination for governor. He will face three other candidates in the August 28th primary, former Congresswoman Gwen Graham, Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, and Winter Park businessman Chris King. The leading Republicans are Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam and Congressman Ron DeSantis of Palm Coast. Let's go to Facebook now. And so many questions for you, Phil Levine. Here's one from Robert. How will you help make our schools become the most academically competitive in the nation?
Great question. Right now, I think we're rated about number 45 in the country, and our teachers earn about $10,000 less than national average. How can we lure great companies to Florida if we do not invest in our schools? For me, investing in education is a priority. Making sure our teachers are compensated at a higher level and it's competitive on a national level. Because listen, look at these organizations that are coming and they want to come to Florida. They're saying your education's inferior. We can't come because the kids and the families of our employees don't want to come here in Florida. Now, I'll tell you this, competition's great and private schools are fantastic, but I do not believe we should be investing our money in someone else's business, which are charter schools. In other words, we own a business. It's called the public school system. Let's make it the best we have.
Would you undo the legislation that's been passed in the state, making it easier for taxpayer money to go to vouchers and private and charter schools?
I believe that we should invest in our public schools. And I believe that anything we can do to increase investment in our public schools are what I am going to do. I'll use an example of the post office. Some people are critical of the post office. Some people think it's good. But do we need to go invest in DHL and FedEx and UPS? That's a competition to the post office. We own the post office. Right now, thank God, we own the public school system. As governor, my priority will be to make it the best in the nation.
And that leads me to another question. Here's one from Tim. How soon will you begin to raise taxes after you're elected? Republicans will accuse you of being a tax and spend liberal in the general election, of course.
Well, it could be a little bit tough because the fact is I'm not going to raise taxes. And I believe that we don't need to raise taxes in Florida. We have a growing budget and a growing state. $89 billion budget comes down to priorities. You know, one of our competitive advantages in Florida is we don't have income tax. That's a wonderful thing. And that's why we're getting folks from all over the country to come to Florida with their wealth, with their ideas, with their vision. So the fact of the matter is there is no intention, no desire to raise taxes in the state of Florida. But you know, Melissa, there's one thing people ask me all the time. Mayor, What's the greatest challenge you face in running for any office? And I'll tell it this, lies. You cannot stop lies on the media or the social media or the internet. There's nothing we can do. People can say whatever they want. You can't fight back against lies, but the American people and the Florida people have smartened up quite a bit.
Okay, so if you would not raise taxes, how would you reapportion all the pieces of the pie to fund your priorities? Better schools, sea level rise and resiliency on the coast, mitigation efforts, $15 an hour minimum wage. How are we going to pay for all this?
Well, first of all, $15 minimum wage is not what I said. I think you just said that. What I believe
you've
is
you've campaigned on that, haven't
no,
you?
No, I've campaigned on Miami Beach. What we did is we realized that every community has a different cost structure. In Miami Beach, we raised it over 5 years to $13.31 an hour. In 2004, the state passed a referendum where the people said, let the local communities decide their minimum living wage. My belief is, yes, it needs to be raised on a statewide level, but then let the local communities decide. Because I can tell you one thing, Melissa, it costs a lot more money in Miami Beach to buy a hamburger than it does in Pensacola. Okay, so that's a cost, by the way, that will save the state money. And you know why, of course, and why it's a big Republican issue, minimum living wage? Because we know people can't live on $8.25 an hour. So if they can't, how are they living? They're living through social welfare programs. You as a taxpayer are paying for people to live. So that McDonald's, which you're real concerned about, because they're paying the people $8.25 an hour, let me tell you one thing about that little McDonald's. That's actually 150 McDonald's owned by a private equity group out of Chicago. And they love Florida. You know why they love Florida? Because you as a taxpayer are subsidizing their workforce. So if we raise the minimum living wage, guess what happens? We actually have more money in the budget to pay for other things because companies will pay their people a living wage and we won't have to subsidize them.
549-2937 to connect with gubernatorial candidate Philip Levine, former mayor of Miami Beach. Paul is in Mandarin right now. Hey, Paul, good morning.
Yes, I'd like to ask the gentleman what his position is on public transportation, specifically railroad passenger transportation, and put a stop to the endless cycle of Florida DOT and stop this endless cycle of building highways and highways to nowhere instead of more effectively using that money to run an effective railroad passenger train system in this state like they do in North Carolina and bring Florida, especially Northeast Florida, bring it into the 21st century for the first time.
All right, thanks, Paul. Of course, Governor Scott, who's leaving office, he turned down funds to create a sort of a light rail connection throughout the major urban areas of Florida. How would you address this?
Well, your caller said it 100%. You know, Governor Scott had a vision economically for the state of Florida, and as you know, that vision didn't require public transportation because the vision for Governor Scott is a state of Walmarts and Applebee's and McDonald's and everybody makes $8.25 an hour. My vision is a state of GE's, Lockheed's, Boeing's and Amazon's and Apple's and eBay's, and with those type of companies, they are demanding public transportation. So like your caller said, it's time for us to invest in new high-tech, high-speed, light rail around the state. Now, every city has an issue that they need to deal with as far as intra-city transportation. We also know that, for example, this Brightline system from South Florida up to Orlando is a public-private partnership. I believe it'll be a home run. I believe we need to continue with public-private partnerships and make it easier for them to create transportation among our cities. Now, I can tell you as a mayor, the big issue is this. The big issue is you cannot access the funds from Tallahassee. It takes too long to get the funds. The environmental process, which is so important, needs to be expedited. No elected leader locally has the bandwidth or the term in office to take this time to actually follow through on a project. It's a priority for me if I'm honored to be elected governor because I know a 21st century economy must have a 21st century a transportation system.
Okay, and that's an investment in the billions, Mayor. How will Florida, you said a public-private partnership. Give me a little more detail about how that would be paid for.
Well, a couple of ways. Number one, we're going to stop investing in necessarily in more and more highways, and we're going to invest in public transportation. Number two, we're going to partner with companies just like the Brightline has done, where they have great investment backing and they're able to put it together. We will expedite the process. We'll make it easier, faster to get it done. And it can be done. And by the way, there's funds out of Washington that are accessible. The issue is the system is broken. It's impossible to get it. And I could tell you that one of the things I will do, God, if I'm elected governor, is I'm going to put the best and the brightest in these positions. But they're not only going to just be the best and the brightest, they're going to be the best, the brightest, and the most impatient. And the Secretary of Transportation will be a very impatient person that I appoint to that position.
Let's go to Bill in Mandarin. Hi, Bill. You're on the radio.
Hey, good morning. Just want to say, in the future, forget light rail. Once the automatic driving car comes into place, that kind of stuff will be obsolete. Also, you talk about the taxes. It seemed to me our such low tax rate, we should have businesses already down here booming to get in. So there must be two or three reasons why we are not a successful drawing state. Good luck on your efforts. Thank you.
Okay. What about those
points?
I think
that's a brilliant, brilliant point that he made. I come from a little town as a boy called Boston in a state called Massachusetts. And matter of fact, one of the large companies that relocated there, General Electric, moved the world headquarters there. And you know why they did it? They didn't do it because somehow the mayor or the governor gave them some kind of cash payout. And they said, whoa, we got to come to Boston now. They did it because Boston has the best public education in the world. That's number one. Number two, they have the best public transportation. And number three, they have an overall culture of excellence. So to answer your caller, he's right. It's like Lion King, the circle of life. In order for us to get these great companies, it's education investment, it's healthcare, it's non-discrimination, it's good environmental policies, it's public transportation. It's all these things together entices these great companies to Florida, not cash incentives.
Sure, but let me ask you as a follow-up. You mentioned Massachusetts, wealthy but expensive blue state. Critics call it Taxachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it comes to cost of living and other quality of life indicators, a lot of politically moderate Americans, and this is a question I've asked your opponents too, they vote with their feet. They flee expensive blue states for places like Florida or North Carolina or the Sun Belt Southwest, where the cost of living is lower, where housing's more affordable, where they can get a decent job, maybe not as high paying a job, but their money will go farther in a low tax state like this. So on the one hand, certainly all of the issues you're talking about attract high skilled creative class knowledge workers. But on the other hand, there is also the issue of some of the policies that become popular in blue states tend to make life less affordable for average people. So how do you split the difference on that?
Well, that's a great question. Well, I could tell you this. Right now, the Florida, our governor seems to believe that if you have great weather, low taxes, and low wages, they'll be beating your door down to come move to Florida, which we know has not happened. Massachusetts, unfortunately, has high taxes. It has high wages. And by the way, the weather is horrible. But they have every great startup and every great company coming to Massachusetts. And by the way, if this whole formula about low wages and great weather and low taxes worked so well, I'm just curious, why has Haiti not done so well? Okay? It's not the right formula. We know that Florida's competitive advantage is the fact that we do not have a state income tax, and we must never have a state income tax. But we need to do the other things to invest in the state of Florida so we can attract these great companies to Florida. I travel all over the world. I've built companies all over in the cruise ship industry. The one thing I have never heard is that Florida is a high tax state. Never heard it anywhere. And matter of fact, the president's new tax laws are encouraging more people to come to Florida, as you know, because they are not able to deduct their local and state income tax in some of these blue states. We welcome them all to Florida. But in the same token, it's time for us to step up and say we just don't want to be a service economy. We want to be a 21st century economy. So your kids, by the way, don't leave Florida to go get high-paying jobs. They can actually stay here in the state.
Okay. One last question for you. You are making a couple of appearances around town today. Where can people maybe come out and see you?
Well, I'm actually at the Baptist Ministers Conference, which is over at the Hyatt Hotel. And it's fantastic. We have African-American Baptist ministers from all over the state of Florida. I hosted a breakfast early this morning, and I'll be speaking late this morning, and then I'm all over the state. We are running a 67-county strategy. There's nowhere we won't go. There's no one we won't talk to reach all Floridians.
Philip Levine, former mayor of Miami Beach. He's running for governor. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you, Melissa.
Much more still ahead later. Educators are speaking out about a new law in Florida they say might lead to a teacher shortage. More education talk later. But up next, a look ahead to this year's One Spark Festival. We'll be right back.
World Affairs Council and UNF partnering to engage citizens in becoming better informed participants in the global community. Coming April 10th, former President of Mexico, Felipe Calderon. Information, worldaffairsconciljax.org.
AEG presents guitarist Tommy Emmanuel performing live at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall, show date Friday, April 6th. Showtime is 8 p.m. Tickets available at Ticketmaster.com and venue box office. More info at AEGpresents.com.
You know what animal is really smart? The octopus. But did you know they could do this?
Octopuses have in several cases learned to turn out the lights in the laboratory. They learn to squirt water at the bulb, which will short circuit the light.
I'm Ann Strangechamps. Cephalopods, gorillas, it's all about smart animals. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRX.
Sunday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT. More than half a million Jewish Americans fought for their country during World War II. Get a sneak peek at the remarkable and little-known story of how these brave servicemen and women struggled against fascism as WJCT, in partnership with the Jacksonville Jewish Center, hosts a preview of segments from the new documentary, G.I. Jews, Jewish Americans in World War II, and a panel discussion with local veterans, Tuesday, April 10th at 7 p.m. To RSVP for this free event and complete details, log on to wjct.org/events. Sponsored in part by River Garden Senior Services.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, One Spark 2018 is coming back, kicking off this Thursday in Jacksonville. Startup companies and entrepreneurs, they're called creators, all receive market validation and they compete for cash prizes. Now, there's a big change this year from the festival's origins. One Spark used to take over a big chunk of downtown. This year, it moves to Daly's Place. With more about that change and what's on tap this year, we welcome Peter Rummel, One Spark board chairman and real estate developer in the city. Peter, good to talk to you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And Darnell Smith, market president of Florida Blue, here with us too. Hey, Darnell.
Glad to be here.
All right, Peter, let's start with you. It's coming back Thursday, a free preview event at One Spark, and then the big festival Friday and Saturday at Daly's Place. People can go to onespark.com for more. Big change this year, moving it over to the amphitheater. What sparked, if I may make that pun, the change?
Well, that's the right question. It's the Hemming Plaza in Lower Street was never the perfect place to put on a show, and we ended up there, frankly, in the early years because of a lack of alternatives. And Daly's Place is a fantastic alternative, and it's built for showing, and it's built for production, and it has cost ramifications, and it has just convenience ramifications. So I think it's going to have a completely different vibe and a completely different feel. And I think the concentration of it is going to give us part of that feel. And I'm excited about it.
Right. And there is a lot of excitement to see the festival come back. Of course, you've put a lot of your own money into this over the years. What would you say to those who are disappointed about the change? They miss the street party atmosphere of the old festival.
Well, let's give the new idea a chance. New ideas are hard. And we have been, I think, methodical about it. Chris Carter, who runs it for us, has done an extraordinary job of sort of rethinking it. And I just think it's going to have a very different vibe and people are going to really like it.
Now, people will come out, look at some of the ideas on display. Will they be able to vote for their creators and as they were able to in the past, even on their phones?
Absolutely. Voter participation is one of the important benchmarks here, and people will be able to vote. And just one silly little example of the difference. We spent $50,000 last year putting a Wi-Fi system up in Hemming Plaza because there wasn't anything there. Well, Daly's Place is already wired. That's just a small thing, but those small things add up.
Right.
And I think in addition to the cost structure, it's just going to be a better environment.
And on Friday and Saturday, One Spark After Dark will kick off with music, beer, and fun, and all of the party aspect of it. Darnell Smith, your market president of Florida Blue.
Yes.
You're here to talk about this, in particular because of some of the creators maybe working on some healthcare innovation ideas, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so as we think about those creators. This is the opportunity for us as a city to really get behind individuals who have devoted their lives to innovation. Certainly these entrepreneurs need our help and support. And when you think about Jacksonville, we have one of the best healthcare environments in the entire nation, having some incredible healthcare organizations right here. When you put together some of these great minds with a number of those entrepreneurs, we have a chance to really help our region out quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask both of you, what can some of the top creators at this year's event win? What's the incentive this year at OneSpark in terms of prizes, recognition, startup funding? That's why so many people have been attracted to this.
Well, there is prize money. There's $50,000 in prize money that gets spread around to people. But more importantly is exposure and the opportunity to present your case to investors or entrepreneurs or the other people who really make this happen. Mm-hmm. One of the lessons I've learned in doing this multiple years is that there are a lot more ideas than there are people who know how to execute it. And our goal here is to take the best ideas and then put the resources behind them for to help people make something a reality.
Sure. Darnell.
May I also piggyback off of that? I'm right where he is. And so as you also think about that exposure, these individuals, the creators, will have the opportunity to build incredible relationships with individuals who are giants in the healthcare industry or whatever industry for which they are actually putting forth their ideas. And they get the support. They'll be seen as viable business people trying to get their ideas to market. And it's about helping to support them and being able to make that happen.
We're talking about OneSpark 2018 right now with Board Chair Peter Rummel and Darnell Smith of Florida Blue. It's onespark.com for more. There will be different zones at Daly's Place this weekend. MindSpark, TechSpark, HealthSpark, as Darnell's been mentioning, LifeSpark, WorldSpark, lots on the website to look at. Did you ever think about just pulling the plug on this when it was in the downtown footprint and the cost was ballooning? And I know you'd given some interviews in the past where you'd really weighed that because it was expensive, and I'm sure it still is.
I'd be a liar if I said no, but I am excited about this transition. I think I think we're on to something here, and I just can't wait for the next few days because I think it's going to make a world of difference.
Let me ask you on another note. You've been in the news, Peter, for a number of things recently. On February 18th, you spoke to the New York Times and said that as a major Republican donor, you decided you weren't going to support any political candidates that weren't behind an assault weapons ban. This, of course, in the wake of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas high school shooting. You've also in recent days said you thought that the legislature didn't go far enough with the laws that it passed about gun reform. Can you talk a little bit more about what's informing your thinking on that? And will this affect your support of candidates this upcoming cycle, including Mayor Curry, people running for governor, maybe running for Congress? How will this affect your donations to those candidates?
Well, I don't want to get into specific names, but I think it is a national crisis. It certainly is a state crisis. And I think the governor's made a great first step in his effort, but we've got to be brave here. And we just can't have this happen again. So, and I personally don't understand why anybody needs an assault rifle to do anything. And I'm not a hunter, so I can't give you a personal testimony, but I don't own guns like your prior guest, but I just don't understand it, and I think we've got to take a stand, and it's going to start from a grassroots groundswell sort of position.
Will it possibly motivate you to contribute to Democrats rather than Republicans? Is it that important to you to cross party lines or not?
I think it's an open field, and I'm not going to limit myself to anything. I'm looking for people And I also think there's a danger in being a one issue person, because the life is more complicated than that. So I'm trying to put it out there and make it an issue that I think deserves the level of scrutiny that it's gotten. But in the end, it's got to be tempered.
What's been the reaction to your public comments about this?
It's now the people who think I'm an idiot don't come up and tell me that, which is nice of them. But I've been amazed at the support.
You've gotten positive feedback.
Oh, unbelievable positive feedback from places I didn't expect it, frankly.
Like what?
Well, just people I didn't expect it from.
Are you going to continue to support Mayor Curry? He really hasn't taken a position on this.
No, it's not a mayor's position here. It's going to happen at the state and national level.
Well, you know what though, John Payton, former mayor, he was part of Mayors Against Illegal Guns, Republican mayor. That became Every Town for Gun Safety. So mayors have weighed in on
this. Okay, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'm a strong supporter of Mayor Curry's, and I'm sure he will see the light.
Okay, let me ask you on another note while we've got you here. The latest news on the development you've been planning on the South Bank, the district, mixed-use development with residences and retail. It's now looking like the city and the Downtown Investment Authority are looking at a straightforward incentives package for this development. Your thoughts on this whole process and where is the district right now?
It has gotten very complicated and convoluted. We have straightened it out with the help of the DIA and the City Council over the last 60 days. We're very positive about it. I expect to be starting this summer, and I think we've got a simplified package, which is not special and fairly kind of garden variety. It got a little exotic, and that was a mistake. And we've reshuffled it.
In terms of how it will be funded, the public and private dollars?
Yes, yes.
The gentleman that was just in here, the former mayor of Miami Beach, he's run on sea level rise and climate change and resiliency as a signature issue. Most of the Democrats running for governor are campaigning on that. You're looking to build a major property on the water. We just saw massive inland flooding after Hurricane Irma here in Jacksonville. What are your thoughts about how this future project could be affected by rising waters, and what's your plan to mitigate with that?
Well, we'll engineer to take care of it, but the fact is we took a look at this site the day after the downtown flooding, and it was high and dry. So everything that's on the waterfront is not equal, and this was in good shape, but to the extent we have to deal with it, we will.
Okay, let's go back to what we brought you both in to talk about, OneSpark 2018. It kicks off Thursday night at Daly's Place with a free preview event, and then the full festival Friday and Saturday. Darnell Smith, Market President of Florida Blue, your final thoughts about OneSpark and what it means for Jacksonville.
Well, you know, when you think about what Jacksonville is going through, just a great transformation, and certainly a transformation for the good. And when I look at what innovation can mean for any region, especially being known as an innovative region, I just think we're on the cusp of something very, very powerful, very impactful for Jacksonville. And so I really urge the folks in Jacksonville, even those within earshot, wherever you may be, we'd love to have you there. We think this is going to be great. Be there for our entrepreneurs, for our creators. Help them to find their way. Help us identify the top creator of the year. And more importantly, to help us be able to select who's going to bring maybe the next transformative
next big idea.
So,
Peter Rummel, Darnell Smith, a pleasure. Thank you both, gentlemen, for being on the show today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you.
We will be right back.
Tens of thousands of teachers say they're at their breaking point. Many were emboldened by a successful strike in West Virginia. Now classes are canceled in Oklahoma and Kentucky, and other states face action too. What should we do for teachers who are overworked and underpaid? And should they ever go on strike? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, Madeleine Albright talks about her book, Fascism, A Warning. She writes, "Some may view this book and its title as alarmist. Good. We should be awake to the assault on democratic values that has gathered strength in many countries and is dividing America. Albright was the first woman Secretary of State. She was appointed by President Clinton. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Dirty, delayed, and dangerous. Three words to describe the New York City subway system. Now add DEAR, D-E-A-R, as in expensive.
I think the challenge that New York has is that we've got years, decades of high-cost habits.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Why, oh, why does the new subway line cost so much? We'll tell you next time on Market Play.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Politicians in Alabama attracted Mercedes-Benz to their state decades ago. With generous tax breaks, non-union labor, they even train Alabama students to meet German labor specs.
We set it up in conjunction with Mercedes to make sure that our processes fit what they really wanted and what they wanted their employees to look like.
How Alabama became a major car maker, it's the world. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, a new Florida law is poised to make sweeping changes to the state's public schools, creating the nation's first ever private school voucher program for bullied students. Also, all schools will be required to display the words "In God We Trust" on school grounds. And also, Florida teachers unions must go through a recertification process if membership levels fall below a certain threshold. Critics say that's a union busting measure and could lead to a teacher shortage. Bob Boyd is counsel for the Professional Educators Network of Florida, or PEN. He's on the line with more about this. Hi, Bob.
Hey, how you doing, Melissa?
Great, thanks. Thanks for being with us. Now, PEN's not a union. You're not trying to step into collective bargaining, but you are speaking out about this issue. Why is that?
Yes, we are not a political organization. We're an organization of professionals. You know, we think of teachers as professionals. But I think there's two myths that nobody talks about with 7055 and the decertification language. And that is, the first big myth is that collective bargaining results in higher teacher salaries. And it's just not true. If you look at Georgia, for example, our neighbor, they average about $8,000 more per high school teacher than Florida's average salary. They do not have collective bargaining. We have collective bargaining in our Constitution, but they do not. They have a state salary schedule where the legislature funds the salaries, and it sets a minimum salary, and every year they may increase that funding based on cost of living increases and that kind of thing. But there's no connection between collective bargaining and better wages and conditions. So I would tell teachers not necessarily to panic, because there's alternatives and different models around the country, and Florida's salary really lags behind the national average.
What would be alternatives that you would be encouraging teachers in the state to look at?
Well, I mean, one thing you could look at, and this has happened over the last 20 years or so, Calhoun County did not have a union. They did professional negotiations with the school district, and their salaries didn't lag behind any other county in Florida. The other thing I wanted to say is, you know, collective bargaining, the other myth is that it's really meaningful. But when you really dig down into it, teachers' annual contracts, their sick leave, their retirement, even all the laws that affect teachers, like whether you can remove a violent student, that's all in the statute. You're really collectively bargaining over a small percentage of dollars that are available through the feds and through the state and the district. And you know, I just think that there's better models out there that we could look at. And instead of, you know, teachers joining a union thinking that their collective bargaining really is going to result in higher salaries, there's organizations like PEN that protects their legal rights for one-fourth the cost, that we can look at some alternatives.
And in our area, it appears St. John's County might be the county that most would be looking at changes under this new law. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's what I've heard. I don't know how many counties would be affected by this. You know, my estimation is, I've heard that the teachers union may sue over this law, which would put it on hold for a while. But I think St. John's is one that's hovering right at 50%. But, you know, what I would tell teachers is, I look at teachers like professionals, like CPAs, lawyers, accountants, journalists, And, you know, they, you get a salary and you do your job. And collective bargaining to me is so adversarial. And I don't know, I guess the model came from the Northeast, but it's not necessarily the way, I don't believe, to increase pay and conditions for teachers. And if you look at it that way, that may be, you know, something that you may consider going forward.
We'll continue to follow this. It's a sweeping education bill Governor Scott signed into law just recently. Big changes coming to the state's schools. And Bob Boyd, your legal counsel for the Professional Educators Network of Florida, PEN, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. And 1A is up next as educators across the nation take a stand for better compensation. Just what we were talking about. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. Keep listening for 1A if you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. Stay tuned for music. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.